near until hell freezes over. With some mutual edification.
They're approximately the same. So
our practical experience with facts is valid, even though we are slightly less than factual the minute we leave abstract mathematics. Absolutely pure fact, I think we know in mathematics. When we say that water freezes or boils at thus and such a degree centigrade, this is only an approximate fact. Air pressure, altitude, purity of the water, all of these introduce minor traces that adulterate the purity of that fact. Nevertheless, this is a practical fact. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
We can use the word practically in saying water boils at 100 degrees centigrade and freezes at zero. Now, facts are inconcussable, which means you can't do anything about them. They're rigid. 2 plus 2 equals 4. You can throw a temper tantrum. You can get down. You can throw your oatmeal on the floor. And it has nothing to do with the fact. See, there it stands, see? That's what the word...
Get hot.
You can, yeah, that's what the word inconcussable means to me. It's in the papers here. That's why I use that four-bit word. It's absolutely rigid. Take it or leave it. God is spirit, but paradise is not. That's a flat fact. Truth, on the other hand, is amorphic, which means ever-changing in form, the opposite of rigid. Truth is living. Facts are frozen. I don't want to call them dead. But they're static. 2 plus 2 equals 4 is there, it's been there, it will be there. Even God can't alter that mathematical fact. They stopped with 7 master spirits. They ran out of possibilities. That's right. You can't go any further. Which it makes 7 very sensible when you think about it. Truth varies. Truth has got elements of goodness in it, which facts have nothing to do with. Facts are neither good nor evil, they just are. Or as one German philosopher put it, jenseits von Böse und Gut, beyond all good and evil. 2 plus 2 equals 4, to call that good or evil is ridiculous, isn't it? It's like discussing, do you want razor blades or shoes for dinner tonight? See, it's out of context. Does that make sense?
Sure.
The word good or evil has no application to mathematics. It just is. It's factual. Now, truth, real truth, must be good. It cannot be true without being good. And complete truth is also beautiful. It is attractive. Truth is living. Facts are frozen. Let me give you an illustration. I've used this in a talk on this subject. Now, let me tell you a couple of fables here. And let's not make him go on all fours. But I'm over-dramatizing the difference between truth and fact. I've got to over-dramatize it to get it through. I searched for an illustration of fact without truth. And what I'm really saying is relative facts with virtually no truth. Because I can't get them in their absolutely pure state, see? But practically speaking, this is fact without truth. A well-informed but very unwise parent clobbers little Oswald, age 7, with a whole, complete, detailed, gory story of the birds and the bees. Nothing left out, absolutely nothing. And this is a shock to this child and scars that child. And let's say that that story is exquisitely factual, detailedly factual, with pictures. And the child recoils, and the child is severely hurt by that story. This is a bad experience for that child. I say there was no truth in those facts at that time to that child. This was not good. Neither was it beautiful. I tried to conjure up the opposite. Truth without fact. And I never did think of a story, but I ran into this little anecdote. And I just chuckled. I said, I've been looking for this for years. A young student of anthropology went on a field expedition with his professor to the island of New Guinea. And up in an upland mountain valley, they spent the whole summer with a tribe living in the Stone Age. Study their Maori customs, you know, their mating practices, their brides parades, the puberty ceremonies and whatnot, and left. 8 years later, the young man, by now an assistant professor of anthropology, headed an expedition to the same valley, in the same mountainous area in New Guinea. And the old chief recognized him. And he came up to him and he says, you big man, you're a child now. And the professor, I mean, after all, he's a professor in a big university. He says, yes. He says, how many wives do you have? And the anthropologist unhesitatingly answered, six. How much cost these women? And again, without hesitation, the anthropologist answered, 10 cows each. You big man, your tribe now. If the anthropologist had given the chief the facts of the case, to which he had one wife who cost him nothing, there would have been no communication whatsoever. The chief simply wouldn't have understood this. But if he had six wives and he paid 10 cows apiece, he's a big man in his tribe. The anthropologist communicated. We now have a fair example of truth without any facts at all. Yes. That's right. Now, I've distorted seriously, but I've got to distort to dramatize the difference. When you're dealing with truth, there's an old expression, meat for men and milk for babes. You must adapt your interpretation of facts to the situation. There was an old darky who used to stand guard outside of the office of the president of Standard Oil. And you didn't go in to see Mr. Subert without clearing through William Oxford. He was an old Pullman car porter and an awfully nice guy. And I had pooled my heels, my share of time, waiting to get in to see the big boss. And William and I would pass the time of day. And William was talking about a survival party in the Pacific Ocean. And they were just about at the end of their resources when a seagull split and they caught the bird. And then it rained. The Almighty looks after his children. Now, to me, those were chance circumstances.
Not for me.
But I wouldn't argue with William for all the tea in China, because we're each entitled to our interpretation of those episodes. And I'm not in the business of attacking faith when I encounter it.
Maybe God didn't, but some of God's children did.
This is true to William. This is not true to me. And I refuse to quarrel. Do you follow me? Truth involves interpretation. Truth involves an adaptation. Jesus gave truth to some of the 12 and admonished them to tell no man. They had the capacity to ask Nathanael, got the master all by himself. And he said, Master, would you trust me with the truth of the scriptures? He smelled. He had a keen nose, and he saw that Jesus didn't quote them all. Mm-hmm. And
all
he suspected, the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And Jesus smiled, and he said, yes, Nathanael. Because Nathanael had the capacity to absorb what Jesus was to tell him. But when
without
he got through,
it
wouldn't hurt Nathanael.
But
let's consider an imaginary conversation. There was a Persian, undoubtedly a Zoroastrian, who arrived at the Pella encampment, Tehermah by name. And the 12 talked to him, and he got ready to pack and leave in a huff. They took him to Jesus, and he unpacked. And afterwards, they asked Jesus, they said, how come we struck out and you hit a home run? And Jesus grinned, and he said, you tried to take something away from him, and I tried to give him something. And I tried to reconstruct what might have happened there. And I can just see someone of the more theological-minded of the 12, and remember, these are Jewish monotheists who look askance at Zoroastrianism, which apparently is a dualism. You've got Ahura Mazda, the god of light, fighting Ahriman, the lord of darkness. It's not really dualistic in eternity, but on the time level, they fight on equal terms. And they've got fire as a symbol. And I can just imagine one of them saying, now the first thing we've got to get straight on is you've got to quit worshiping fire. And another thing, no one contends with God on equal terms. At which point the Zoroastrian is whistling. And I can imagine Jesus talking to him and using words perhaps like this. Just as fire chases away the shadows of the darkness of evil, so does it also burn away the dross of error from the gold of truth. And this is good semantics talking to a Zoroastrian.
Yeah. Bill, that was the thing that was worrying you the other night about this omnipresent discussion we were having. There was George and Mac and another woman that was coming. We come when I seen you met at Eva Park. I was afraid that we were getting in the position of contracting.
Do you now see why Jesus used parables?
Yes.
He could handle freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors with parables. You older timers, if you've got a freshman in your group, be a little temperate in your questions. Meat for men and milk for babes is still pretty sound. And there are things which we would talk about and just have a ball with and kick them around. I'd be a little hesitant if we had a lot of freshmen here.
But that's all right, because you showed up and George came to that.
You can't live facts, Wilma, but you can live truth. You can know facts. You can't live them. You can't live the law of gravity, but you can aspire to live the love of God. Yes.
Can anything be good and not be truth?
Not in the real sense of the word good, only in the distortions of the human mind. The Greeks offer in their philosophy and in their culture much that is beautiful and much that is true. but they suffer from a lack of an equal amount of goodness. The Jews had a tremendous concept of goodness and morality, but they suffered from a lack of beauty and from a lack of philosophy in their religion. Christianity draws on both cultural resources, and that's why it was so appealing to the Roman world. At first, the Romans made the early Jewish Christians get dressed up in Greek togas before they take them seriously. And when the Jewish sect Hellenized itself, then it became acceptable to the Roman world.
That's why Christianity and
Judaism
is tied together each time.
They sure need to be,
but
Roman.
It could be. You could have something good then from what you said without it being true.
Not in the real sense of the word good, only in the human, distorted, evil, error sense.
Mm-hmm. Then the Jewish religion was distorted.
Yes, so was the Greek philosophy. The Greeks suffered from a lack of the concept of goodness. The Jews suffered from a terrible lack of beauty and a considerable lack of philosophic truth. The Jews never philosophized very much.
In other words, you have none of these if you do not have all three. In the
real sense of the word, they represent error and evil admixed with. You have a lack of symmetry. Something is missing. Something essential is missing. The good must be true and beautiful. The true must be good and beautiful. The beautiful, if it's really beautiful, must be true and good. They're inseparable. They're the comprehensible elements of divinity. When you unite them and experience them, they come out as love, mercy, ministry. God is love. The Son is mercy, love applied. And the Spirit is ministry, mercy in action. Yes?
Relegate this to its correct position, the statement the farmer makes, the Son is hot.
That's a factual statement. Relatively factual.
Is that a fact? That's factual.
This isn't necessarily.
It's not in the realm of truth or untruth.
It's not necessarily good or beautiful. It's a statement of fact. The sun may be too hot. This may be bad in the farmer's concept. His land may be parched.
It's in the realm of fact, and it is a relative.
Yes.
Less than pure mathematics is relatively factual.
That's right.
Other than pure mathematics.
Right. But facts deal with things in our practical experience. Truth deals with meanings. Goodness relates to values.
Goodness relates
to values.
Truth relates to
meanings. Interpretation. The most that a thing can be is beautiful.
Well, it's beautiful, the unification of contrast.
Well, no, you can have beauty in inanimate things. A design may be beautiful. The most that a meaning can be, or an interpretation can be, is true. And the highest value is good. Goodness. Harmony. Harmonious pattern. Or the beauty of concept.
The three types of energy, spiritual and physical.
Oh, yes. I think seraphim must be very beautiful. Why wouldn't they be? There's beauty in this book. Beauty of concept, beauty of the use of the English language. I think it's well that the book wore the garments of beauty rather than being written poorly. It's bad enough to read it even when it's beautiful.
Not bad enough,
Jeff. You know, I don't think you can separate these three things. Here, let's take a blue-nosed Protestant concept. You know what I mean. Here you have a rather sterile abstraction of goodness, an over-accentuation of morality, a restriction of conduct, a concept which is a victim of Protestantism. It protests against so many things, you know? You don't do this, you don't do that, you don't do the other thing, you don't do this, you don't do this, that. This concept of goodness is very repellent to many, many people. That record of Bill Alexander, where he comments about dancing, you remember? And he heard the sermon that this minister preached on dancing. He says, believe me, that man shouldn't dance.
Mm-hmm. They found one more record. They found one more piece that was recorded now.
That's what I mean. The truth, beauty, and goodness, you see, are mutually corrective. When the Bible says the world is 6,000 years of age, it's talking out of order. The Bible has no concern with the physical origins of this world. That's a subject for an astrophysicist to discuss. And if a physicist says there is no God, he's equally out of order. He's working over in the domain of values. Theologians are not experts on things. And students of things are not experts on values. The physicist, as a physicist, has no opinion about God. He's dealing with a material universe. The theologian, as a theologian, has no opinion about the physical origins of this world. He deals with God and with values. Now, the philosopher can have a Roman holiday because he reaches out for both, see? I think of reality as being kind of like a water molecule. You've got divalent oxygen in the middle and a hydrogen atom on either side. And these two hydrogen atoms in this symbolization don't touch. And here's science and here's religion. And in their pure states, neither has anything to say about the other. If religion contains superstitions, science will purge it because they won't stand up. But a philosopher, he's the oxygen atom in the middle. And he's got to work out a unified field theory here. He's got to say, well, now, wait a minute. We've got a law of gravity, and we've got a love of God, and this universe has got to be consistent. You can't have two centers in the last analysis, although it's interesting to note you do have two centers in next to the last analysis. You have paradise and the eternal sun. But in the final analysis, there is only the universal sun.
We should all aspire to be good molecules of us.
Yeah. Sure.
I want to be a good molecule.
That's right.
Inadroppable.
You see, when you come right down to it, science never quarrels with religion on religious issues. It's only when religion presumes to make scientific statements. Then they have an awful hassle. And of course, the physicists are equally foolish. A lot of them are religious. I would think of a conversation I had after a class in physics many years ago. There was in the class a lad who believed in the omnificence of God. God does everything. And so all you had to do was be a true believer and you won't bruise your feet or nothing bad's going to ever happen to you. You know, just pray and worship and you're going to have it, you've got it made. And that's an Egyptian concept that got into the Old Testament. Well, I was belaboring him after class and pointing out all sorts of Herodotus things that happened to the so-called saints, and just trying to point out to him the theory won't stand up very well. And afterwards, why, my professor beckoned to me, old Dr. Lohr, and I stepped in his office, and he said, "Sadler," he said, "you're not a mechanist, are you?" I said, "Good heavens, no." "Fine," he said, "I thought you were too intelligent to be a materialist. This is a guy teaching physics." We never pursued the subject, but I've always remembered. Then I had a course in comparative religion, and I discovered the instructor didn't even believe in God.
In no food?
That's right. University of Chicago, the departments of religion were pretty much secularist, and most of the physicists and chemists believed in God. It was very unusual. Do you have a feeling for fact and truth?
Well, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
Not for everyone, but it's just a good example to give that when Jesus said, "When you have seen me, you have seen the Father," that's a statement of truth, not a fact.
Of course. Of course. The Father was not 6 feet tall and didn't wear a beard. If Jesus was bearded, I suspect he was. The Father is not a magnificent specimen of humanity, which Jesus of Nazareth certainly was.
Well, the average person, you know, thinks of him that way, but I think of him as light. I don't know why.
I do too, Wilma.
Because universal father
is light. That's not all of it, though.
My symbol for God is a bit Zoroastrian. Against a field of darkness, and it's astronomical darkness, the night of the night sky, I see increasing brilliance as I get nearer and nearer a focal point. I think that is my present symbol for God.
My reason for thinking that is that we are told that our human eyes cannot even discern, begin to discern, way down the line from the universal Father.
Is God beautiful?
Oh, yes.
He must be.
That would be the most comforting, the most beautiful thing
I've ever had. You know, that must be an
experience.
When they tell us how beautiful the heavens are, as we go up mansion worlds and all, it's just fun. It's
really increasing.
You know, when you go in to paradise from the third Havona circuit, and you go into whatever it is you go into, the central shining, they call it in one place, and you penetrate to the heart of that thing, and you actually recognize God. That's your third trip in there. You know, that's going to be a hell of a big experience. And you know,
for millions of years, we're going to be conditioned for that time.
And this is minimum, Wilma. This is just barely. You're just barely recognizing. That's probably it.
Barely deep in the sun.
You stop and think of these primary supernatim, the angels of perfection, the pattern for all angels, the direct creation of the infinite spirit, and how wise they must be. But they've never yet been able to calculate how much worship is coming out up there. To me, the word worship is synonymous with love in the highest sense of that word. And it's a special word which we use to denote the love which a creature bears for a creator.
Bill, I have wondered, you know, they say that we do not know the growth of our own soul. I wonder if we are conscious of how much we love the Lord.
Probably not.
I believe that is something that we do not touch. I believe that our love grows for the Lord as we seek to do His will.
Well, the more you do for anybody, the more you're apt to love them. That's true on the human level. That's why parents love children more than children could possibly love parents. Parents do more for children, and this is a trippy.
Well, I see a few cases where the children do more for parents.
But by and large, Wilma.
By and large.
You're
right.
I want to ask a tricky question.
Those are the best.
Do you think that as we get to Havana and we learn more and we experience more of the Supreme, do you think that this is a necessary attribute for us to recognize some unity of deity before we can ever recognize the Universal Father?
Mm-hmm. Especially on the Sixth Havana Circuit, where we're under the tutelage of the supremacy guides, and where the authors of the papers say we deduce the unseen action of the Supreme Being by what happens to pilgrims going through the Sixth Havana Circuit. Here is where they achieve their pre-paradise comprehension of the unity of deity. And if you'll recall,
in the Eternal Son, we won't get it.
Let me read you a paragraph from there. It's rather beautiful. I'm somewhat at a loss to explain what takes place on this circle. No personalized presence of supremacy is perceptible to the ascenders. But regardless of our inability to grasp the technique, each ascending creature seems to undergo a transforming growth, a new integration of consciousness, a new spiritualization of purpose, a new sensitivity for divinity, which can hardly be satisfactorily explained without assuming the unrevealed activity of the Supreme Being. To those of us who have observed these mysterious transactions, it appears as if God the Supreme were affectionately bestowing upon His experiential children, up to the very limits of their experiential capacities, those enhancements of intellectual grasp, of spiritual insight, and of personality outreach, which they will so need in all their efforts at penetrating the divinity level.